Houston, KPFT.org worldwide.
Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted child activist Dr. Bob Sanborn and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Mandy?
Thank you so much, Don.
Hello. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, Mandy. Did you have a nice weekend?
I had a great weekend. I spent it with you.
That's most... How much greater can it be, right? So, yeah, Saturday morning we were busy working, right? We had a lot of work to do.
The board retreat.
Yeah, we had. But an interesting thing, though, right? Sunday morning the newspaper comes out.
That's right.
The cover of it is a quote from us at Children at Risk.
Sanborn, front page of the Houston Chronicle.
So the big quote, which are the headlines, we have more brothels in this city than we have Starbucks. A big story on human trafficking.
It is. The Houston Chronicle covered it very nicely.
Yeah.
It's a good conversation.
And it's a sad thing, right? Why do we have to talk about us having brothels in this city?
Right.
Which have a lot of, we know, and the one that they busted, you know, there's children.
Right.
That are working there. And
well, and I think most people will acknowledge that there probably are some in Houston, but the fact, there's more than 400? And more than Starbucks?
More than Starbucks. We only have about 130 Starbucks in this town. And then this morning I had one of our staff count how many brothels, because there's a way for us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
196.
Oh, 196.
Yeah, but you're right. We have counted up to 400 on certain, you know, different times. But today, as we speak, 196. So it's incredible, right, that we have more than double the number of Starbucks in our town.
Yep.
So the other thing I wanted to bring up is Kyler, your son. You know, he got one of these little rock machines that turns rocks into gems, right?
Rock tumbler.
Mm-hmm. Rock tumbler.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to sell these to jewelers.
Yes,
is that right?
That is absolutely.
And you're like, you're bringing him to jewelry stores to try to sell them, right? So he can learn.
I did. So he can learn. And he, I mean, there's amethyst and tiger rocks, and he actually knows more than I. I don't know the names of all these rocks. So.
And are the jewelry stores being very nice to him?
They were very nice. They were explaining it to him that they don't buy jewelry. And his response was, well, then how do you have this jeweler here? We don't buy gemstones or diamonds.
We don't buy gemstones. So how do you have this jewelry here?
That's right. He's like, let me talk to the jeweler in the back.
He's like, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? He's just like his mom. You don't give up when it comes to legislation. He doesn't give up to selling his rocks.
I know. And it's, you know what? It's a pain. I'm a pain. The situation is a pain. I'm going to take him to one more place today and then I'm calling it quits. Hopefully. I don't know.
Oh, wow. Isn't that funny?
That's so funny,
the things we do for our children, right?
I know. Well, my husband and I actually were having a conversation because he's like, don't take them. They're going to say no. And I'm like, well, let the world tell him no rather than me stopping him from trying to pursue something that he's interested in. I'll be there to support him when the conversation is had.
Wow.
So that's what's going on.
Very nice. It's a beautiful thing being a parent, isn't it?
It is beautiful.
There's, you know, Andy Richter. I don't know if Andy Richter is. He's the sidekick to Conan O'Brien, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he has this whole series of tweets about being a parent. And one of them, I just broke up laughing when I heard this over the weekend, was he said, you know, the only good thing about having a kid is that if I ever need a drink, like to take a pill or something, there are always about 100 empty beverage glasses or cans around the house. I just need to pick it up, take a sip, you know, because it's like the only good thing about having kids. There's like empty
cans. But you
don't
want to drink after them.
But you do, because you just need a little quick sip. And that doesn't stop at 18, it doesn't stop at 20. It just keeps, the kids just keep leaving their cans half full of stuff all over.
They won't.
Yeah.
Not in the Kimball household.
Yeah, just like, you go ahead and you say that, Mandy. You're like one of those parents that say, yeah, it won't happen. And then a couple of years you'll be like laughing. Oh, yeah, it's going to happen.
It's still happening. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm dealing with it now. I'm just saying I'm putting an end to it.
Oh, you're putting it in because it's happening right now. Mandy, we have a good show today.
We have a fantastic show.
It's a rockin' show, speaking of rocks, Kyler's rock, and a lot of good guests we have going on today.
We do. So
Yeah, we're going to start off today. So our data head, right, mm-hmm. one of our favorite segments, Emily Freeborn, who's a staff attorney over at Children at Risk and the Fight Against Trafficking. She's going to be here with the number 10.
10?
Number 10.
That's kind of a small number.
Yeah. What do we think
or
that
is? Or is it? I don't know.
Is that Kyler's age?
Stay tuned.
How old is Kyler?
He just turned 9.
9. Okay. Yep. So a year from now. Yeah.
After Datahead, we'll be talking with Alex Truteau. He's the Director of Policy and Research at Demand Abolition in Washington, D.C., a great organization. And he's going to talk with us about policies to fight sex trafficking.
Well, we have a couple of sex trafficking stories. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk with Valencia Clay as well. Valencia is a teacher, author, and co-founder of Flourishing Blossoms Society for Girls, and she's going to share with us the benefits of reading, as well as discuss, this is important, trauma-informed curriculum. You know, in light of the hurricane and everything mm-hmm. that's happened, we're going to talk about some of the trauma-informed curriculum with Valencia Clay.
And today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in and share your opinion, thumbs up or thumbs down. Should schools be creaming our most talented students, and should magnet schools be creaming our most talented students? There's an article today, or yesterday.
Yesterday, mm-hmm. right, in the front page of the Chronicle as well. Our good buddy Shelby Webb, who's the reporter with the Chronicle, is going to join us right before we do the thumbs up, thumbs down to talk about that article. Because a lot of changes anticipated within HISD.
There are a lot.
Yeah, so it should
be. Unfortunate.
Unfortunately, right?
Yeah.
Or fortunately, depending upon who you are, right? Maybe you like this whole idea of switching things up.
Well, they're having to cut $200 million. And
that's
I think
never
we
fun.
Can
no one likes
always
that.
Agree that HISD doesn't need to be cutting $200 million.
Actually, right, if we need more money in public education.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Our final guest today is our good buddy, Colleen Dipple. She's executive director over at a wonderful organization, Families Empowered. And we're going to talk about some of the work that Families Empowered is doing in sort of helping parents with school choice. And we're going to talk about school choice and upcoming school choice week here in Houston. And have you ever been to one of those school choice weeks? Apparently, that's a big crowd. People go.
That's what I've heard. I have not been, but I look forward to getting involved in a conversation.
And I had this discussion with one of our staff members. This is very different than vouchers, right? Some people think of school choice as vouchers. Mm-hmm. Different deal. This is like making sure as parents that you choose the right magnet or charter or neighborhood school, which one is going to be best for your child. So
we're going to have a fantastic show today.
I think
today.
It's going to be really good, Mandy.
It is.
And
beautiful weather outside.
We had a little break, right? Last week was our day of service, so everyone was out and about for MLK Day. But now we're back at it.
And we survived the freeze.
Man, the freeze was something else, wasn't it? I was in D.C., actually. You know, I went to D.C. for MLK Day. And I went to that, by the way, I went to that new African-American museum.
Oh, how is it?
That
you were
fantastic.
Excited about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Everything about it, you know, the history, the art, even they even have a really good cafeteria there, which is really, you know, I will find the glory
food.
And food
That's
in
right.
someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really good. But anyway, are you ready to do the data head?
Let's do it.
And so Emily Freeborn, poetry in motion incarnate, is on the line with us. And
hello,
right,
Emily.
Right, Emily. And you're like poetry in motion, aren't you, Emily?
Well, I try.
Yeah. So Emily is over in the Center for Social. She is in the Center to End Trafficking and Exploitation of Children, and she heads up CEASE, Cities Engaged Against Sexual Exploitation. And Emily, you do a great job in the fight against trafficking. What is our number today, Emily?
Thank you for those kind words, Dr. Bob. Our number today is 10. Actually, my favorite number.
Why is that your
favorite number?
Why is that your favorite number, Emily?
I was born on the 10th day of the 10th month, so.
Ooh.
Well, look at that. Isn't she something?
So 10 can be a good number. Is 10 in this situation a good number?
It is definitely not a good number in this situation.
So tell us about it.
So tell us what 10 is.
All right. 10 is actually the number of apartment units out of 70 units that were allegedly used in the operation of a brothel in Southwest Houston that was just recently brought down by the Human Trafficking Rescue Alliance.
Wow. So 10 out of the 70 apartments. And so were they using it like a hotel, Emily? What was going on?
It's not exactly clear how each apartment unit was used, but the apartments were used from 2009 until 2017. November 17 is when they did the raid on the apartments. And it was operated by Maria Moreno Reyna, allegedly, who was one of 24 defendants facing charges for trafficking and multiple other charges right now.
This was a big operation.
It was really big. It was operated by her and family members that were from the Southwest Cholos, a Houston-based gang, which has been around since like 1990.
Which is a large gang, correct?
Yeah, there's about 2,000 members in the gang.
Yeah.
And they found children, Emily, as well, part of that were being trafficked?
Yes, there were definitely children that were being trafficked in this operation. And this, to me, just really highlights, first, the demand, right? Like, if you have 10 apartment units being used, that there's a high demand there. They were open from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m., which is just astounding. So neighbors had to be noticing things. And so it also highlights the need for all of us, especially in this month, this Human Trafficking Prevention Month, the need for all of us to be looking for those signs of, you know, gang activity or women or you know, young people that look to be engaged in prostitution, coming in and out of buildings, things like that.
Emily, one of the things, you know, this story, which was on the cover of the Chronicle, front page of the Chronicle, and, you know, we were quoted in it talking about how there are lots of brothels. But when we look at the landscape of human trafficking, an article like this would make people think this is an international problem. But indeed, when we look at trafficking as a whole, there are more domestic girls involved by far, and the demand is all driven by, or predominantly driven by, residents of Houston.
Absolutely. These are Houstonians that are purchasing these women, and the majority of the people that operated this gang were Houstonians, were American citizens. At least the children of this operator were all American citizens. And yes, there were victims that were recruited from Mexico and Central America, but there were also victims that were taken from right here in Houston. And so you really can't just look at this as an international or domestic problem. And it's just as big, if not a larger problem domestically than internationally.
You know, this is just sickening.
Yep, it is.
Because the reason there are so many brothels, the reason that there was such a large bust, right, and so many victims, is that it is so lucrative for people. And the way that it's lucrative is because there's such a high demand. That's why they're in Houston. They're in Houston because it's lucrative, and it just it makes me sick that we have Houstonians here that are going to treat, you know, our people like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just has to stop.
It's men here in Houston. If we didn't have men buying these young girls and young boys, we wouldn't have a problem.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Luckily, we have a great team here that's dedicated on reducing the demand. We have an awesome sheriff's office and HPD that is really doing their best to combat these issues. So we're working on it, but we also need everyone to be aware of their surroundings and to be making those reports. So if you see something, really say something.
Give us the hotline
number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's the hotline?
888. Yes, it's 888-3737-888.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And you have that memorized. Have you ever called that number yourself, Emily?
I have.
Wow. Very good. Yeah. A lot of people keep it in their phone. I think a lot of us who are in the fight against trafficking, it's in our phone.
In case you can't remember it.
Well, I can never, I can never remember.
You don't know our office number.
I don't know our office phone number. And I, the KPFD number, without me looking, I could not tell you what it is. I'm just, it's just not one of the things I'm strong at. But Emily, you know what Emily's strong at? Fighting trafficking.
Yes, she is.
She's really good in the fight against trafficking. You're going to be on the program next week, right? Mandy's away. I think you're our guest host, right, Emily?
Yes,
you're with me.
I am. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Yeah. So we've done that before. Emily's a good partner.
Yes, she is.
Mandy's getting a little jealous, Emily.
I am.
Don't worry, but I'm not gunning
for
you.
Good
hands. It's okay.
Emily Freeborn, the Center to End Trafficking and Exploitation over at Children at Risk. Thanks, Emily, for all you do. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, guys.
All right,
take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT, Pacifica Radio. Mandy and Dr. Bob here. Mandy, I'm going to keep up this conversation. Do we have a little theme music for Alex, by the way?
What about us? What about all the times you said you had the answer?
Is that your favorite song, Mandy?
It's a good song.
Yeah, it's a good song, right? So Alex Truteau is with us. Alex is the Director of Policy and Research at Demand Abolition over in Washington, D.C. Alex, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. I think this might be the first time I've ever been introed in with theme music, so it's a real honor and a privilege. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I think we kind of pride ourselves on the theme
so
music.
So next time you walk into a room, you could like bring a little boombox or something and just sort of play that song, right? Just
I might have to start every Monday morning out walking in with theme music. It's a good idea.
There you go.
It is a good idea. I think I'm going to do that too, Mandy. That was a good. You had good theme music, though, Alex, I must say. So, Alex, Demand Abolition, you know, we're very engaged with Demand Abolition as well. But tell me a little bit about policies that are fighting sex trafficking that seem to be particularly effective in this country right now.
That's a great question, because I think many, if not most, lawmakers at the local and at the state and at the federal level are all really interested in doing something about a problem that they rightly deem as a heinous, persistent problem affecting Americans across the country. Including, as Emily mentioned, kids and adults who are born here, as well as those who are coming in from abroad, all of which is driven by demand. And so I think it's really helpful to look at legislative efforts at the state level, but then also at the federal level. And that's where I focus, is on federal legislative approaches right now. And we've got, it's actually a really exciting time in Congress to be focusing on anti-trafficking work, particularly on what I would call accountability in anti-trafficking work. So I think if you've got two major threads of legislative focus areas around anti-trafficking work, one would be victim services, making sure that when someone is harmed in a trafficking situation, that there's the resources available and the services available to help them recover. But then the other is, what are our policy solutions on the accountability side to hold not just traffickers accountable, but ultimately to hold the buyers accountable who create this lucrative market the traffickers seek to profit from?
Well, I was about to say, this is a conversation that's a long time coming, because I know that I've been talking about human trafficking and working on anti-human trafficking laws for over a decade. And you're absolutely right, Alex. When you talk to policymakers, they think that human trafficking is horrific and there's no tolerance and we're going to go after those traffickers. And yes, okay, let's enhance those, you know, those penalties. And then when it came down to services, we've turned the corner, because now they're actually putting money for those needed services, right? Which was a fight.
That's right.
But still on the demand side, even though they say it's so horrific, there hasn't been enough done to end the demand.
No, there hasn't been enough done. But I think you're starting to see members of Congress wake up to that fact now, and they're starting to ask really good questions about what they should be doing. And so one of the most exciting pieces of legislation right now, it's actually the one that it's on the back burner at the moment, unfortunately, but I do believe that Congress is going to move to it next here soon, which is the reauthorization of our nation's marquee anti-trafficking bill, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, or TVPA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this bill needs to get reauthorized every few years, and it historically has contained a lot of authorizations for funding for victim services, but right now it's doing exactly what you're talking about, which is to say, let's go up extreme a little bit. Let's focus on prevention, and particularly let's focus on prevention by reducing the amount of perpetration. That ultimately is how you prevent a form of violence, is to address the perpetration. And so the reauthorization that Congress is currently stewing over right now with TVPA has a lot of new provisions in it that would strengthen our nation's approach to demand reduction, including adding in new layers of transparency and reporting to make sure that at the state level we're being transparent about what demand reduction is being done, including new training requirements for local law enforcement agencies, as well as other supports to encourage more demand reduction done at the local level, because we're realizing now that that demand reduction work has to be done as part of a holistic approach to combating trafficking at the local level.
Alex,
TVPA is really getting that moving forward.
That's great.
Alex, you know, this idea of training law enforcement, you know, Mandy, that was in Texas 10 years ago. That was one of our first pieces of legislation, was the idea that we need to train law enforcement around trafficking. And over time, what that means is law enforcement becomes on your side. They understand the problem. They understand the challenge, and they become with you. But it seems like it took probably 8 or 10 years before law enforcement became our best friends on this.
Sure.
I mean, they were always good friends, but it takes a while. And do you see that, Alex, federally and in other states where law enforcement could be better friends with the fight against trafficking, but they haven't had that that re-education part?
I do. And the way I think about it is like this. I've worked with so many law enforcement agencies across the U.S. over the years on this issue. And when you start to see those law enforcement agencies understand just how bad the victimization actually is, it starts to reshape their thinking about who these buyers are and what they're really doing to people. Because I think a lot of folks are raised on the idea that somehow someone bought in the sex trade isn't as bad as we know it to be. And it's only when law enforcement have that kind of contact with victims that they really understand just how significant of an issue it is that we're facing. And they understand that the traffickers are important to hold accountable, but really we got to go further and address the demand directly. That's when I see that light bulb moment happen. And so it starts with victim services, it starts with victim recovery, and then it evolves into, wait a second, I want to be holding these guys accountable in our work. So it's great to see that light bulb go off, but you know, there's still a lot of progress that needs to be made.
Right, absolutely.
So tell me, where does Texas stand in regards to the data collection? And you were talking about accountability. So I know Houston took the first step, and then a couple of sessions ago, we were able to get legislation passed of when people are arrested, for example, for prostitution, which oftentimes human trafficking is involved in that, correct? There was no distinction between the buyer and the victim. And so we found that as a huge win, so then we can at least start educating people, saying this is what's going on. Are those conversations happening in other states and at the national level? So are we catching up, or were we leading the pack there?
I'll say a little bit of both.
Okay.
The good news is that you identified the issue pretty early on. I would say that Texas's data collection was, I think, behind the curve a little bit initially, so playing catch up, but doing so admirably. And really what this boils down to is that if you're not tracking how many of those arrests go to buyers versus go to individuals in the life who might be victims, then law enforcement agencies and oversight agencies really don't know where their resources are going.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many times I've talked to cops who say, I think most of the work we do is demand. And then you show them the data, and it's really not.
Yeah.
So it's very different thinking about it in terms of your own personal history and what you've been involved with anecdotally versus what's happening at even a city level, let alone an entire state level. So that transparency and reporting is so important. I like to think of it as, you know, sunlight being the best disinfectant here. The more we can be talking about what's actually happening, the more people start to do the right thing because they want to do the right thing on this issue.
Alex, our final question in the last 30, 45 seconds here. When we look across the nation and we look at ending demand, is there a state that's doing, or is there a law that you're very hopeful for that can do a particularly good job in that area of ending demand and something that we should be fighting towards?
There sure are. I think there are a couple of states or cities that are doing this particularly well. I'm not sure how many of them have fully built this into their policy approach, but my number one wish list is always this. when buyers are held accountable through the criminal justice system, when they are lawfully adjudicated for illegally buying someone for commercial sex, whether that person is a trafficking victim or not, and usually they are, but they're not ready to identify as such. But when they are held accountable, it's very important that there's a significant but fair fine levied against them, and that that fine goes to two purposes. One, it goes to supporting victim services to help make good of the wrong that they've done. But then number two, it needs to go toward additional law enforcement training at the same time, because that provides the feedback loop that helps law enforcement stay on top of this trade, help them understand what the new trends are, and that keeps the whole thing going in a way that is sustainable for law enforcement and at the same time is reducing the amount of demand that's causing that burden of victim services.
Wow. Is the direction we need to go. And Alex Truteau is the Director of Policy and Research with our buddies at Demand Abolition. Alex, thank you for the work that you and Demand are doing, and thanks for being on the program today.
Thanks so much. Keep up the great work. We're really proud partners.
All right.
Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Growing Up in America, KPFT, Pacifica Radio, and it's Mandy and Dr. Bob. And are you ready for our next one, Mandy? It's a pretty good song, Mandy. And this is that's the theme music. Valencia Clay is with us. Valencia is a teacher, author, and she's co-founder of the Flourishing Blossom Society for Girls. Valencia, how are you doing today?
Hi, how are you? I'm doing well.
Very good.
Thanks for having me.
Did you like your theme music, Valencia?
Yeah. Next time, make it Cardi B, okay, guys?
You got it. So, Valencia, I know that a big focus of the Flourishing Blossom Society for Girls is reading and then also trauma-informed curriculum. Talk a little bit about that, Valencia.
So, right now, we're noticing, specifically in many urban cities, that there is a decline in reading levels across the board, and reading levels meaning true data, like students are not reading at home. I'm not even talking about like state tests or, you know, any of those formative assessments,
You're not looking at scores, just the amount of time kids are reading.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so like I have a class of kids who the first day of school, I asked how many people, you know, how many books have you read? And most of them said zero. They've never finished an entire book on their own. And so as shocking as that may sound, it's pretty common. So what we're trying to do, not just with Blossoms, but using my platform on Instagram and things of that nature, is bringing reading back to the forefront. And it's amazing because I was reading an article about how Teen Vogue is going out of print. Like there's so many publications that are not going to be in print anymore. Like there's a loss of the love for the books. And for
so
our
is
children,
that is that why that there's a decline?
No,
is that that they're not reading books, or are they reading social media or online books, or what is the reason for the decline? Would you say
there are many reasons, but in my where I am, I feel like it's because their attention span, they just don't have that love for reading. They want to do everything else but read, and they haven't been taught that there are so many things you can learn that will enhance all the other things that you love from reading. And so, yeah.
And what do you do with the Flourishing Blossom Society for Girls? What is it that you're doing with these girls, Valencia?
So we started about 8 years ago. We primarily work with them on the issues that girls need to talk about and learn about, so like beauty. Specifically right now we're doing colorism and thinking about skin color. On an international level, like the girls last week watched a documentary about colorism in India. We're taking them this summer to the Dominican Republic and Haiti so that they can look at how colorism has played a role, a tremendous role in the way people view themselves in those countries. We teach the girls how to be of service to their younger peers. They also have mentors from neighboring colleges.
Talk a little bit about colorism, though, because I think that's an interesting concept. How does that impact young girls and some of the girls in the Flourishing Blossoms?
Everyone is different, right? But we have many of our girls who are of darker complexion, you know, admit to feeling like they weren't pretty enough compared to other girls in media or other girls in our classroom. One of the most devastating, you know, experiences I had was on the first day of school, we were playing a game of telephone, and the message came back at the end that, you know, all Africans stink. And, you know, that speaks volumes about self-hatred among your own, you know, culture, because 90% of my students that year were, like, their parents were African-born. They were first-generation Americans. And so it just goes to say, you know, our children are learning not to love themselves because of media sometimes, because of their parents being, you know, not even aware of the messages that they may be sending, may or may not be sending. I know even my own grandmother, she had a strong, you know, enslavement mindset coming from the South, moving to New York. Even now, like, she'll say things, and I'm like, Mom, I don't think you should say that, you know. Mm-hmm. But this is what they were indoctrinated in without even knowing it. And so we are erasing those.
Well, and talking with these girls, I know another aspect of Flourishing Blossom Society for Girls is trauma-informed curriculum. And there is all kinds of trauma, right, that these girls are exposed to. And, I mean, of course, being in Houston, we think of the trauma that, you know, thousands of children experienced with Hurricane Harvey.
Right.
But can you talk a little bit how you incorporate that into the curriculum and conversations?
Of course. So all of our trauma-based curriculum is grounded in literacy. And, like, our girls, their trauma really stems from, you know, drug abuse in their families or, you know, molestation or being raped. They have a lot of internal trauma that you can't see unless you know them. Like, you wouldn't know. You can't. These are the mental illnesses that people can't see. And most of them are not diagnosed with any emotional disabilities. They don't know anything about therapy. So what we're doing is teaching them how to recognize their triggers and how to recognize when they feel those things and what to do, who to go to, and not necessarily to avoid their feelings, but to confront them and be liberated with different soothing mechanisms for themselves. And so we do that through reading. There are so many, like, you can read almost any book and connect it to one of their issues specific, like, for instance, we were reading Odysseus and how he, you know, got the Cyclops drunk. And that became a conversation about what it looks like to be an alcoholic and why did he even get him drunk and, you know, taking advantage of him. And it became a whole conversation about who's uncle, who, you know, drinks in their family, their dad, their mom. Like, I had no idea that this was going to happen. And so we've literally seen every week anything we read is allowing these girls to open up about their own personal life. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful because they're walking away with tools now to soothe themselves and even their family members.
Wow, that's powerful. Well, and it's a great opportunity to allow those girls to relate, right? So here you're looking, reading at books, but gives them a safe place to talk about what's going on and to try to cope.
And Valencia, what cities are you guys in? What cities are Flourishing Blossoms in right now?
We're right now in Baltimore and in Harlem. We're in D.C. for a while, but those were like baby blossoms. We had elementary girls at that time.
And are both cities pretty easy to operate in, or is it tough going the whole way through?
What do you mean by easy to operate in?
I don't know. Is it easy to recruit youngsters to be a part of the program?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because they come straight from our school, so. And everybody wants something to be a part of.
They do, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Their parents are super supportive. We're right now, like, we're really working on how to serve the parents as well and get them the same lessons that the girls are getting, because what we realize is we can teach the girls all day, but if they're going back to the same environment,
right,
it's not as effective as we would want it to be. So this is a new challenge for us, educating our young parents. It's well worth it, though. It's well worth it.
Valencia Clay is the teacher, author, and co-founder of the Flourishing Blossom Society for Girls out of Baltimore and Harlem. Valencia, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and thank you for being on the program today.
Of course. Have a nice night.
All right. You too. Thanks. Take care. Bye-bye. Yeah. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT. Pacifica Radio. And are you ready, Mandy, for a little thumbs up, thumbs down?
We are. Yeah, I am.
Yeah, I'm ready as well. Boom!
All right, so today we are talking about, should magnet schools be creaming our most talented students? Thumbs up, thumbs down. We encourage you to call in and give us your opinion. They took the phone number.
713-526-5738. Yeah.
What's that number right. again? What is
that's
it?
That's 713-526-5738.
I just looked up to where the number is all the time.
Thank you, Don. At least, Don, you have it memorized.
Yeah, I have it memorized.
Yeah, yeah. You think I would, right? It's only been 12 years that I've been on the air here.
Yeah,
so,
that's okay.
You know, 713-526-5738. There you go. So if you want to give your opinion on magnet schools, Mandy, what is your opinion?
I mean,
on
this is kind of timely as well,
yeah,
right? Because they were talking about it with HISD. I mean, I think magnet schools serve a purpose. I don't have anything against magnet schools, to be honest with you.
Do you think, though, that, you know, when you have a magnet school, is it creaming the best kids out of all the neighborhood schools?
It's creaming some of the kids.
Yeah.
I do think
it is. How
do
you think that has an impact on the neighborhood school?
So, I think that when you're taking some of the best performers out of the school, that's difficult, right? Unfortunately, those schools, right, their GPAs will drop, their test scores will drop, and they're a bit penalized. So, it makes it more difficult for the schools. Absolutely. But I also think that if you have bright children who can thrive and are interested in certain issues and can think a little bit outside of the box, then why are we going to try to stunt that growth? And so that they need some help. So just as when we have children who have been identified at risk, they get additional dollars and additional services, which is absolutely needed. I'm not saying take it away from them. Absolutely
right,
not.
Right.
We need to boost them up. But I also think that other children should have an opportunity as well.
It's interesting when you look at Houston, DeBakey, the school, high school for health professions, Carnegie Vanguard, the high school for performing visual arts. These are some of the best high schools in our country, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, I, as you know, I'm a big supporter of magnets and I love these schools. And I wonder, though, if these schools are taking an inordinate amount of money away from some of the schools. And you and I we've fought at the state legislature for more money for some of these poor neighborhood schools.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, you know, it's in a society where we don't have enough money for public schools,
right.
You know,
it's a hard conversation.
It's a very,
very
hard conversation. So are you, your thumbs up for magnet schools?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Big
are
thumbs
you?
Up, right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But I think there are some big questions
there's some
there,
valid
right?
points.
And it's interesting. I do believe, though, and you and I, we've talked to superintendents all over the state, and there is a mindset of not, you know, superintendents aren't so much in favor of magnets, right? Because of that sort of inequity in money.
And I understand their position. Like, hey, because to be honest with you, if you have high performers, those could be great leaders in a particular school, right? Or peers that are helping. And I mean, so it's a struggle.
But it's hard to argue because if you're a parent, you want the best possible school for your child, right?
And I think that's why there's magnets.
And when we have these great magnets, and these are the best possible schools for a lot of kids, though there are a lot of parents that are left out that want to send their kids to these schools,
mm-hmm.
which maybe makes a case for more magnets.
Right.
But as a parent, you want these really good schools, and these are some excellent schools.
They are.
Yeah.
But, I mean, again, I can't stress enough how important it is to make sure that all children's needs are met. And we can't just keep the eye on the magnet saying there's the opportunity. Every public school should be an opportunity for every child. And our work isn't done until we get schools and students to the goals that we've met for them or set for them.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we're not talking about, though, is this. There are a lot of schools, and you see this within HISD, that say, well, we're going to be a magnet for a certain, you know, so your regular neighborhood school, and they're going to be a magnet, and they want extra money for their little magnet, which really isn't attracting others' kids. It's just a way of getting more money.
But is it not attracting more kids, or is it helping the kids that are in that particular school?
Well, it's getting more money for that particular school, but it's not a real magnet.
Right. Well, then that is the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
If it's not a real magnet, then that is the problem.
That is the problem.
Kind of like Montessori schools, you know. Anyways, I did some research, and people say, "Oh yeah, I'm a Montessori school," but I'm like, "You don't have any Montessori curriculum going on at all.
Oh, yeah.
What's the deal?"
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But parents know those buzzwords, right? And so then they're jumping on and saying yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So we do have some people calling in. Let's try in. We have Sydney on line one. Sydney, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. So what are you thinking on this magnet school thing, Sydney?
I'm thinking that, you know, we're insinuating that there's a scarcity of, like, good students, which is a shame, because although there are some people that are, like, naturally talented or gifted, shall we say, but I hope that everybody would agree that everybody has potential.
Yeah. Yep.
Even though Johnny doesn't learn as quickly as Bobby.
That's right.
Or Bobby has a shorter attention span or what so have you. I think that if we were to, I don't know, adapt public schooling, then we wouldn't be so angry at or disturbed at these changes or the recruiting of good students.
I think you're right, Sydney. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah, we agree with you exactly. So you're sort of taking the thumbs up, thumbs down out of this, right? I mean, it's really not a matter of thumbs up or thumbs down for magnets for you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very good. Hey, Sydney, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
All righty. Let's go to Christina. Christina, you're on the line. How you doing?
Hi, good.
Very good.
I'm thumbs down.
Yeah, tell us about that.
I'm thumbs down for magnet school because the higher level programs can be offered in a public school such as AP and pre-AP. Because right now in the district I'm in a very small district on the east side of Houston, and we don't have magnet schools. We're a one-school high school district. We are Title I. We do have both ends of the spectrum. We have smart kids, and we have kids, let's say, that get into fights. But and so I guess that is maybe the fear of parents that have high-achieving kids is, I'm just going to say it, you know, what if my kid gets jumped on the way home, you know, or my kid is harmed. However, when you have a really good administration that is on top of sending kids that are in, you know, that have different violations immediately to an alternative school, that gets weeded out quickly, you know?
So in a sense, what you're saying, Christina, is that you don't like the idea of a magnet school, but you like the idea of magnet classes, right? The AP and pre-AP.
Exactly. And I think that affects school culture. When you pull all the magnet kids or all the pre-AP and AP eligible kids out of the school, that affects the entire culture. For example, I'm not going to say my district, but
that's okay.
Our culture is sometimes affected where we won't do homework because no one does homework. The kids don't want to do homework. We're only allowed to fail 10%, la, la, la. And that's a whole other subject in itself. But culture is affected. You know, whether you have AP kids or not is affected, whether you have low, you know, so I don't want, you know, public schools to be stripped completely of magnet kids because then there is a culture of low achieving, but I think it's good to have high achieving. And some of the kids in our school take pre-AP classes even though they're not going to get a distinguished diploma.
Yeah.
So I'm a Spanish teacher, and I have a lot of students taking pre-AP and AP Spanish. Now, they're not taking any other pre-AP or AP classes, but at least they got a chance of taking one class that they have a strength in.
Sure.
No, and they're able to read literature and stuff. You know, so yeah, I'm thumbs down, and I think it can all happen in one school if it's properly administered.
Yeah,
you know,
Christine, good point, Christina.
On top of everything, I think everyone can co-inhabit, and I see in my classroom that everyone can positively, you know, affect each other, and that's what creates the school culture.
Hey, Christina, thanks for calling in.
And culture is
no
really
problem.
Important.
Yeah.
Thank you. We talk about the importance of culture all the time, right?
Yeah.
And how, I mean, I agree with her that it can be impacted, and to have people who have leadership and good examples is always good.
Yeah, very good, very good. You ready for, so that was a good thumbs up, thumbs down, right?
It was.
It seems like whenever we do education issues, we have more people call in, so.
People are vocal about education.
Yeah. So that's really good. So are you ready to talk to Colleen?
Ooh, I'm a rebel, just go kickstart. I've been feeling it since 1966, yeah. Happy over now.
I don't know that song. That's a good one. Do you know it?
I do know it.
Yeah, that's a good one. Really good. That, nice theme song, Colleen. So,
Is that my theme song?
That was your theme song. Colleen Dipple's with us. She's the executive director of Families Empowered. Colleen, how are you doing today?
I'm great. I have a really upbeat theme song.
Yeah, yeah, right?
Happy Monday.
Well, you're an upbeat sort of person, too. So that's
exactly, apparently.
So, Colleen, give us sort of the quick rundown for people who aren't familiar with Families Empowered. Talk a little bit about what your great organization does.
Yeah. So, you know, our mission is to empower families to engage in the marketplace of schools. And what that really means practically for the families we serve is we connect families to schools and schools to families. So we provide a free service to families in Houston, the Houston metro area, San Antonio, and Austin. We partner with ISDs, we partner with charter schools, we partner with the Archdiocese and other private schools that generally have a history of serving working class folks. And we make sure our families know about deadlines and, you know, application processes and which schools have space. So we serve to really kind of build this a bridge between the families and the schools around just access, and we strive for greater equity for our families in terms of their access to schools.
And we just had a robust conversation about magnet schools.
Yeah.
I wonder, you know, you have a lot of families who sign up with Families Empowered because they want to go to some of the great magnet schools in HISD. Mm-hmm. How many families sign up, and how many actually get in, and how many are sort of left on waiting lists in your program?
Well, so the interesting thing is we don't have access to the, you know, magnet school wait list. There are thousands of families who are not getting into magnet schools, for sure.
Yeah.
We have essentially partnerships with some of the higher performing charter schools, and we have about 26,000 families in our database right now who applied last year to either Harmony or Yes Prep or KIPP and are sitting on a wait list. And we do know that of those 26,000, at least 50% of them are also zoned to HISD, and then the others are zoned to some of the surrounding districts.
So that's a lot of parents who are deciding that they want to go to a good magnet or a good charter. They're trying to do a little bit better for their kids.
There's the lack of quality seats. We talk about quality seats all the time, right?
Yeah.
So my question for you.
That's really good news, by the way. For our city, we have so many parents who really understand that quality is important, and that's what they're looking for.
No, that is
really
good.
Yeah.
And well, and that kind of was going to be my question. When there are families and parents that connect with you, is it more to stay abreast of what are the current conversations, what are the opportunities, or are they parents who are saying, I don't like the situation, I've got to find something else, and I don't know how?
Well, actually, it's very mixed. Most of the parents who come to us initially are saying, I'm looking for something other than my, you know, zone school, and I need help, right? Mm-hmm. Or I've applied to this charter school, and I'm on a wait list. What are my other options? We actually have a call center, and it's a fully bilingual call center, so we call all those 26,000 people, and we've surveyed them every summer, and what's interesting is we also, in those calls, we help them understand what their options are, and often we will tell them, you know, about every option, including, you know, we really urge them to look at their neighborhood school and to have conversations with those principals about what matters to them. But this thing that's interesting is we do know why. So we actually ask, it's a dialogue, we ask them why they're looking for alternatives, and the number one reason is academics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's very clear. And so we help those folks. Now, there is, to your question, there's sort of a second group of parents who are really wanting to, you know, engage and dialogue and improve the system. But the majority of our families are, you know, they're working class. They're often working two and three jobs. And they just really want the best school for their child, it's a pretty significant anchoring issue for a family.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, we have families who really, in a sense, often say that when it comes to your own children, everyone's an elitist, right? You want the very best school that you can afford and that's available to you for your child to be able to go to. I know we have a big event that I want to talk about, but one other quick question, and I'm surprised I've never asked you this before, Colleen, but you know, we have this whole list of these high performing schools, you know, like Deschamps and Lions, that are really neighborhood schools but are gaining an A or a B in our children at risk rankings. Is that something you tell parents about too?
Yeah. So, I mean, one reason we really appreciate what Children at Risk does is because, you know, honestly, you all have been providing a very clear way to understand, you know, schools that are really high quality, schools that...
They must have crossed lines or something.
Yeah. Very exciting. But your rankings are significant. So we share those out, and we certainly, in those phone conversations, you know, tell parents to look at those because there are these really interesting bubble schools. I think the work that you all have been doing on tracking, you know, SAT scores and outcomes is really has been you're providing useful tools for families who really want a simple way to get to one really important data point, which is how well is this school performing academically, and are they improving, right? So that's something we talk to schools, we talk to parents about. We also, by the way, encourage them to use that as one point, and then we suggest they visit every school, including their neighborhood.
That whole idea of visiting is such a good thing, right? I mean, we talk about that so much with colleges, but parents very, very rarely do that with the elementaries, middles, and high schools.
You can put anything on a piece of paper.
It's a big thing.
So I know that you have, Colleen, Families Empowered is hosting a big event to engage parents. Talk a little bit about that. It's January 27th, and I hear...
this weekend at Minute Maid Park.
RSVPs are out the door.
Yes, so we are excited. We are just helping to coordinate. So we are, I would say, we're hosting with a coalition of really incredible schools. So we've got participation from, you know, actually KIPP Houston, Houston ISD, Yes Prep, A Plus Unlimited, Harmony, Yellowstone. It's going to be a great free event this weekend, January 27th, yep, on Saturday, 10 a.m. at Minute Maid Park. And the event is really about celebrating the choices we have. We're calling it our Stronger Together event. It's going to recognize our communities, our parents, and our schools. And our focus is, our message is really that we're stronger when we work together to support all parents. Mm-hmm. It benefits our kids when we're actually collaborating and building a bigger tent. We also have Cristo Rey Jesuit and the Archdiocese and Spring Branch participating.
How do parents sign up, Colleen? If they're hearing about this and they want to go, they want to let someone else go, how do they do it?
Yep. So they can go to our website, which is www.familiesempowered.org. They can follow, they can check us out on Facebook. There's a way to find out about the event and then to register. They're not required to have a ticket. There's about a 4,000 person capacity. As of today, we have 2,300 people who have RSVP'd. We're really excited about that. And then all of those partner schools I listed are really promoting and pushing this event. It's just a great opportunity for all of our diverse schools and all of the teachers and parents and kids to come together.
And learn about what the options are, right? Mm-hmm. Learn about some of these options.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, I think we'll all have a table. We'll have an exhibition hall. There will be an opportunity for parents to come and families to come to talk to schools directly. We're going to have a really great program. We actually have Representative Dan Huberty and Senator Larry Taylor, who chair both the Senate and House committees, are going to speak.
And we have...
I thought it was going to be an exciting event, but now I hear those guys are speaking, so...
Yeah, it's good that they're showing up.
Yeah, it is good.
It's really good.
They are.
And
it's going to be a great event, so...
There's also going to be some fun where kids can run the bases. Orbit will be there.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Register now.
Is Jose Altuve going to be there? That's who I want to be there.
Well, that would be... We may have a couple last-minute surprises, but, you know, okay. There's lots of people who are more hip than I that are hard to get.
But you'll be there, so you'll be there. You ready for a Final Four with Colleen, Mandy?
I am. Colleen, this is an opportunity for listeners to get to know you a bit better, so we have some questions. The first question is, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
Whoa. Oh, my favorite toy. It depends on what you mean by a kid. I got to say, I love my bike.
Your bike? That works. That gave me
a lot of freedom.
You're cruising all over the place, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
You know, I actually wanted to be a doctor.
Oh, where did you grow up, Colleen?
I grew up about 90 miles north of New York City in a little town called New Paltz, New York.
New Paltz. Mm-hmm. I know New Paltz. Wow.
Yeah. Teeny tiny, kind of hippie town.
Yeah.
What was your favorite book to read as a child?
Oh, well, so I think when I was really little, I loved those crazy Richard Scarry books that had like where, you know, cars and trucks and things that go. I loved just those label books. And then as I got older, I liked anything by Judy Blum was really great.
Wow.
Yeah.
Judy Blum.
And then our final question today on Growing Up in America on our Final Four at 54. What was your favorite subject in school, Colleen?
I'm going to sound like a real weirdo. I loved math.
We've had math lovers before.
At least you didn't say recess.
You know, thank you very much, Colleen, for that. And I encourage people to look up Families Empowered because the work that you're doing is extraordinary. One of our favorite partners. And keep up the great work you and your team are doing, Colleen. And thanks for being on Growing Up in America today.
Great. Well, I really appreciate being invited, and I hope you all have a terrific week. Thanks
all right.
so much.
Thank
Take care,
you.
Colleen.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. So another
great organization.
Yeah, it is
they're making
good...
a difference in Houston.
They
People
are.
Should look them up.
Yeah, yeah, they're doing some good things. So another program, Mandy.
Another one down.
Mandy, there's so much work. You know, we did a lot of things, talked about a lot of things today. The need for our schools to be better. We talked about the need for more reading to be happening in a lot of our communities. And we talked about what's happening with trafficking here in Houston, here in Texas, and across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some stuff going on that really needs to be addressed. Mandy, when you look at our state, and as we get ready for the next legislative session, we had a bad legislative session for kids last time. Do you have hope or you feel like this is going to be a big struggle continuing on?
Oh, I think it will be a struggle
moving
forward. But that doesn't mean that we won't make progress, and that absolutely doesn't mean that we're not going to try. And so I think that we have to stay the course. What are the issues that we think that can really benefit children and families and let them know?
Yeah, and people need to be
active. And vote in the primaries.
People need to vote. And in Texas, everything's decided in the primary. Vote then and vote and be loud. Let people know. Speak up for kids because kids don't vote and kids can't have their voices heard unless you're doing it for them. So take care of the kids in our community. Hug your kids. Literally and figuratively, make sure that all kids are represented. Thanks to Don and Marissa, our producer, and Jane Bikini, who does such a great job. Thanks to Mandy. We'll see you all next time here on Growing Up in America for Children on Pacifica Radio.
Attention job seekers. National Career Fairs is hosting a live hiring event in Houston on Saturday, February 14th, 2018. Interested in participating? Pre-registration is free and easy. Simply mouse on over to nationalcareerfairs.com. Then click the Career Fair Calendar tab and select Houston. Don't forget to wear business attire and bring multiple copies of your resume. And you're all set. This event takes place at Houston Marriott South at Hobby Airport, 9100 Gulf Freeway, Houston, Texas, 77017, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. For more details, visit nationalcareerfairs.com.
You're listening to KPFT Houston.
The forested land around our bayous act as the kidneys of the water system. They clean out pollutants and help manage flooding in times of high rainfall. Preventing more Houston land from being covered in concrete ensures that more of the precious little water that falls has the ability to soak into the ground and our aquifers. Living with water shortages or damaging floods brings to light how connected we all are to the natural world around us. Our health suffers without clean water and fresh air. Families suffer without safe places to spend time together outdoors. Bayou Land Conservancy, a local nonprofit organization celebrating its 20th anniversary, works to permanently protect land in the greater Houston area, with a special focus on the 13 watersheds that feed Lake Houston. Please visit our website at www.